Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Shayna Estelin, correspondent for I-24 News. And our moderator this week is Jim Malone, VOA National Correspondent.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's show. Here are some of the issues we're going to be looking at on Issues in the News this week. The impeachment inquiry targeting President Donald Trump gains momentum with key testimony from a U.S. diplomat who worked in Ukraine. Congressional Republicans vent their political frustration over the impeachment process with a public protest. Overseas, President Trump declares success in Syria in the wake of a ceasefire, but the hasty U.S. troop withdrawal has sparked new questions about the threat of Islamic State fighters, the fate of the Kurds, and Russia's growing influence in the region. Meanwhile, back here in the U.S., the presidential race is gaining new momentum, and new polls give encouragement to Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren in the same week in the battle for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Well, thanks to both of our guests for joining us this week on Issues. And Linda, let me start with you in terms of taking a look at where we are on the impeachment inquiry involving President Trump. And we should remind everyone at the moment, this is the beginnings of an inquiry in the House of Representatives, where Democrats have a majority. They are propelling this process. But there did seem to be a rather significant turn this week with testimony from Ambassador William Taylor.
Right. So Mr. Taylor had been the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And then when the Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch was withdrawn and called back to Washington abruptly, he was asked to step in. And in his testimony, he produced a gasp-inducing moment when he said that there were two channels of U.S. policymaking and implementation, one regular and one highly irregular. The regular one was what it had long been, support with the bipartisan backing of Congress for Ukraine against Russian aggression from the East. And then the irregular one, which was essentially a shadow foreign policy, was a concerted effort led by President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to get Ukraine to investigate alleged corruption by Joe Biden and his son, and even alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 U.S. election, which is a conspiracy theory that's been, I think, thoroughly debunked.
Shayna, let me bring you into this. It seems as though what we're seeing in the House in inquiry so far is Democrats taking witness testimony. Now, they're doing this in private at the moment, though Republicans are involved in that. But they seem to be building a case, piece by piece, about President Trump's actions regarding pressure on Ukraine to get investigating the Bidens and other aspects of the 2016 election.
Well, the Democrats, and I think Nancy Pelosi realized this early on, they've got to build as much as an airtight case as they can, because so much of this has to do with public support. And if the Democrats are seen putting together a weak case, there will be backlash, especially in red state areas where you've got vulnerable Democrats. But what's interesting is that you see Republicans, and we saw this with a protest by Republicans this week, they're not so much trying to defend the president on the content coming out of these hearings. Again, closed doors, so we're only getting leaks and such. But they're going after the process, which is that it's behind closed doors. There wasn't a formal vote in the House to launch this inquiry. And that's what you're hearing also from Lindsey Graham yesterday, who introduced a resolution to condemn the inquiry, not based on what's coming out of it, but based on the way the Democrats are pursuing this investigation.
Yeah, there was a dramatic moment. I think the Democrats might call it a stunt when a couple dozen House Republicans sort of forced their way into the hearing room where the testimony has been going on. It does seem as though Republicans, Linda, generally are showing some reluctance to address the central allegations here that the president was doing something that was, in the view of some, either A, improper, or B, possibly illegal, in terms of trying to get Ukraine to investigate
a political opponent, and also holding out, and this is a key part for the Democrats, I think they're trying to develop the evidence, holding out the prospect of actually holding up military aid to Ukraine as pressure.
The problem for the Republicans is that, in fact, although these hearings are happening behind closed doors, we're seeing the opening statements. They are being released. So we are seeing in black and white on paper what people like Ambassador Taylor said, which is that there was this two-track foreign policy going on and an evident quid pro quo pressuring Ukraine to help Donald Trump in his domestic political process to help him win re-election effectively. So Republicans, as Shana said, they're arguing on process. And I think they can make that case. But if anybody thinks about the core allegation of a president asking a foreign country to get involved in our domestic political affairs, it's pretty shocking.
And we should remind everyone that from the beginning here, this was sparked by a whistleblower complaint. There was the release by the White House of a summary of a call transcript. The president has said from the beginning that the call was perfect and the Democrats are out on a witch hunt. But Shana, I'm starting to wonder about the timeline of all this. The behind closed doors aspect is taking time. More witnesses may be called. We're hearing talk about maybe former National Security Advisor John Bolton now possibly in talks to testify. That would be quite an interesting spectacle. But I do wonder, eventually this will go to a public process. There will be most likely testimony in front of the House Judiciary Committee or some version of committees that are looking into this. And I just wonder where we're headed just in terms of the House process. Are we looking at the end of the year? Could it slip even further? What's your thought?
So many questions in that one question, which is good. But you know, I just want to mention one thing about the timeline that you brought up is that the call that sparked all of this between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine happened the day after Robert Mueller testified. And what it appears to be is that the president saw Robert Mueller not doing a very good job in the testimony and felt confident and emboldened after that, sort of liberated to then go on and ask another country for help going after a political opponent. So that timeline is very interesting. And if we're looking at the timeline of this whole process, it seems like it's going to be a couple of months. I mean, there was some talk that this would wrap up, that this would go to the House for a vote, perhaps before the holidays, but I don't see that as being likely. Once it goes to the House, or the House votes on these articles of impeachment, it then could go to the Senate, where the trial will take place, essentially, where senators will be the jurors here. But Mitch McConnell has to decide, does he want that to happen? He gets to choose. Does he want to dismiss what the House does, or does he want to see it play out in the Senate, where the president will likely be acquitted?
And the Democrats, we should remind people, back in, I think, 1999, when the actual trial was held in the Senate on Bill Clinton, actually there was an effort by one of the Democratic senators to simply dismiss the charges that fell short. So they actually went through the prospect of a full trial, and Clinton was acquitted on both
charges.
Right,
but Mitch McConnell has said he'll have a trial,
right,
which is important because that suggests the need to really play this out in public. And it's a trial, so we can't confuse a legal proceeding of a trial with an impeachment trial. This is not technically a legal process, although impeachment and then the subsequent trial are informed by American laws.
I think impeachment, we can sum up, it's a very political process. It has aspects of legality in some of the terms, but the fact is that, for example, during the Clinton impeachment time, his approval ratings actually went up. And it was almost a foregone conclusion, as I recall covering that at that time, that he was going to be acquitted. So they will do their due diligence in terms of carrying out their impeachment duties, but they have an eye on public opinion. And speaking of that, I've noticed the president's approval polls weakening in the last few weeks. It's been not huge, but he's closer to a 40% approval now than, say, the mid-40s, where when he's at his peak,
right,
he can
so
do better.
For these members of the House and then the Senate, if assuming there is a trial, all voters for Republicans, their voters are Trump voters. That is the key to this whole thing, is how the public perceives this. Does the public think that Donald Trump should be impeached? And we are seeing some erosion on the edges, particularly in key battleground states. So these are states in our election next year where the president needs those electoral votes to win the election. And we're seeing on the margins some decline in support for the president and increase in support for impeachment, if not removal from office.
On this segment, as we kind of wrap it up, but Shana, I do wonder, Republicans are very much focused on trying to attack the process. That's the best way they see right now, apparently, to defend the president. But I wonder, is there a fear among some that they may not know everything that they need to know as this process unfolds and the Democrats in the House continue to get more testimony and more information?
Well, that's the big complaint that we're hearing from Republicans, that this is happening behind closed doors. The president can't defend himself. But as you pointed out, a couple dozen Republicans are allowed into this. They are allowed into the process. They're not being shut out in the way that they're complaining. One other thing I do want to point out is at the same time this impeachment inquiry is happening, William Barr and the Justice Department, they have just, or according to multiple reports, they're now launching a criminal probe into the Russia investigation, which will play out really well in conservative media and could be a welcome distraction. So that might be part of the strategy, too. We attack them on the process because maybe we can't really defend the president on the content, but let's also distract everyone and let's talk about the 2016 election and what Hillary Clinton did or didn't do.
Right. And I think, too, what we should look for when it does become a public process, I think this is one thing Republicans want. They want the right to call witnesses. They want the right to cross-examine people in public. And as we've seen in other investigations like the Mueller, they're going to be very willing and eager to bring up some of these theories that have been voiced before without a lot of substantiation, if any. But I think it's going to be a political distraction tactic. And I think that's one of the reasons why they want to move to an open proceeding.
Right. But I thought it was also interesting that, as you had mentioned, Senator Lindsey Graham, who is one of President Trump's closest allies in the Senate, attempted to get a vote denouncing the Democratic process in the House, and he failed, which they didn't even have the vote.
Right.
So this idea that the Senate is 100% certain to acquit President Trump and allow him to stay in office, I think we need to watch that. I wouldn't put that at 100%.
Right.
We've got a lot of senators sort of sitting, watching. They'll move as a herd. They won't move one by one. We do have Senator Mitt Romney kind of out there as the lead critic of President Trump. But there are others who are sitting there quietly watching. And I think at a certain point, it's possible, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but it's possible that they just decide they've had enough for a variety of reasons,
yes,
including even foreign policy, the situation
right
in Syria, and just move en masse and vote to remove him from office.
We'll be watching the Senate Republicans very closely. And of course, under our system, the Senate acts as a jury, essentially, during an impeachment process. Well, we're going to leave that subject and we're going to take a short break right now. But when we come back, we will turn our focus to the situation in Syria and an update on the U.S. 2020 election campaign.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Shayna Estelin, correspondent for I-24 News, and our moderator is Jim Malone, VOA's national correspondent.
And welcome back to Issues in the News. We want to shift focus now away from the impeachment controversy, which is absorbing Washington, to an international situation that much of the world is watching very closely. That's the situation in Syria. We've had a number of developments this week. I won't try to encapsulate everything, but we did have the president at one point coming out and basically proclaiming the ceasefire that's gone into effect as a success, trying to take credit for a situation that, of course, he had a key role in initiating earlier on. And now we've got situations where the situation on the ground looks to be somewhat confusing. There's aspects of what happens with Islamic State as a threat, what happens to the Kurds, and, of course, the status of Russia and, you know, vis-a-vis the United States in a sort of a superpower rivalry in that part of the world. Let me bring in Shayna on this. What stood out to you this week in terms of developments on the situation in Syria?
Oh, my, there's been a lot. I would say the latest that I'm tracking is that the Pentagon is going to be beefing up the military presence in Syria, actually, despite the president saying that he's going to be sending troops home to now protect oil fields in the eastern part of the country, likely sending tanks, which is a big deal. It means that there'll be a sizable presence to control and protect those oil fields from ISIS. On that, there's a number of things here. First of all, the president has said that we've defeated ISIS, so the fact that they're afraid that ISIS is going to control oil fields fails means that ISIS is not defeated. The other thing is that it looks like the president, instead of committing U.S. troops to protect Kurds, who were U.S. allies in the fight against ISIS, is instead committing troops to protect oil. And the last thing is, the president has suggested that he wants the Kurds to go and help control the oil fields. Big question is, why would the Kurds ever want to help the United States again when they just were essentially abandoned by the U.S.?
This was such an abrupt move by the United States, and I'm sure larger powers around the world are still trying to get their hands around the implications of where all this is headed. It just seems to be a confusing situation to kind of follow day to day, and I just wonder, do we have any better sense of where this is headed? Are we expecting more conflict based on what we hear from Syria and from Turkey? Or where do you see this heading in the short term?
Sure. So the president came out and said the ceasefire was a victory and that his decision to withdraw troops was the right one based on the fact that he is a person who has campaigned and as president has really taken this isolationist view of getting troops out of the Middle East. Why do we have to commit these troops to, you know, sand that's been fought over for hundreds of years, basically. But the reporting on the ground right now is that the ceasefire is not holding up, that Turkey continues to attack Kurds. And even if the fighting did stop, the bigger picture here is, and this is what we heard from Republicans, is the long-term damage this will cause to the United States' reputation, again, for abandoning an ally like the Kurds. And what kind of message does that send to other allies in the region, like Israel, for instance, who has seen the U.S. be a reliable partner? The other thing it does is it lets Russia advertise itself as the best friend anyone could have in the Middle East. Look what we did for Bashar al-Assad. Look what we did for the Syrians. And look what the United States has done for their ally, the Kurds.
You know, Linda, at this time, President Trump really needs to rely on Republicans because he's battling to save his presidency in terms of the impeachment. But he went and did this and immediately got a lot of pushback from Republicans. It just seems like maybe it's a typical, you know, example in the Trump era of the kind of, he is the disruptor, he decides what the agenda is. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that he justified this by saying he made it a campaign promise to pull American troops back from these war zones.
No, it really all gets back to his voters and Donald Trump's perception of what he needs to do to keep his voters with him. So he is, I would say, almost obsessed with fulfilling his campaign promises. And he's running what he calls an American first, America first foreign policy, which means getting out of foreign entanglements, which means pulling U.S. troops and forces out of places all over the world. And it sounds good to his voters. And if you go to a Trump rally and listen to his voters speak, this is absolutely what they want. And this is a long-standing American tradition, a long-standing strain of thought among American voters, going back to the early 20th century, if not before, that we need to focus first and foremost on American interests, take care of our own. And it's obviously a very narrow view of how the U.S. protects itself. Obviously, to me, allowing ISIS to reform and possibly do damage again is potentially extremely dangerous to America. And so we don't know when and if that will manifest itself, but it's almost shocking. But for the president, who likes to explain his actions in very simple terms, this works for him. He can get up at one of his rallies and say, look what I've done for you. I've pulled our men and women out of harm's way. They're coming home, and now we can focus on our country.
You know, and I guess if they're just focused on that and not our place in the world and how we're seen as, you know, reliable allies, maybe they won't care so much about that. But looks like the resulting power vacuum here is an invitation for Russia to really assert itself, Jane.
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, this is a giant gift for Russia. They can say, look what we've done for Bashar al-Assad. I mean, Bashar al-Assad was essentially losing the Syrian civil war before Russia came in and decided to help him. And so they basically have all the leverage right now in Syria. Just as a reminder, Russia's ally in Syria is Iran. This is coming at a time, so Russia's, you know, their stock is going up in the Middle East, but it's coming at a time when the United States is trying to build a coalition in the Middle East to fight Iran. So it's not a good move for the United States to let Russia have all the control if, as this administration is trying to combat Iran. And again, I'll point out what that means for the United States ally, Israel, who's very concerned about Iran's growing presence in Syria.
Well, there's a lot to track on this story, and we'll be following in the weeks to come. But I do want to pivot back to the political situation here in the United States, because all the talk of impeachment and watching what's going on in Syria has kind of overwhelmed our election campaign, which is only about 3 months away from actually starting with votes in the Iowa caucuses in February. And Linda, I just want to get a sense from you, because we had some interesting polls this week. One poll showed that Joe Biden had a solid lead in the Democratic field, but then another poll the following day showed that Elizabeth Warren has sort of moved into the lead. Obviously, the two of them are at the top. But where do you see the Democratic race at the moment?
Right. I think it's in flux. I mean, and I read an interesting fact that at this point in the election cycle, the Democratic leader has never won the presidency. But the question is, who is actually the leader right now? So Joe Biden is winning in national polls for the Democratic nomination, but our nomination process doesn't happen on a national basis. It happens, as you say, in primaries and caucuses that go state by state. Elizabeth Warren is leading in Iowa, the first contest. So the first two contests are Iowa and New Hampshire. And if Joe Biden does poorly in those two contests, then the bottom could fall out of his support. And we could very well see an Elizabeth Warren nomination, which has Democrats very, very worried. Democratic establishment, who are more moderate than Elizabeth Warren. A lot of moderate Democrats see her as too liberal, too progressive to beat Donald Trump. Wall Street is scared of Elizabeth Warren and her call, for example, for a wealth tax to go after the wealthy.
So, you know, Shana, on this issue, I mean, Trump has dragged into this controversy on Ukraine. You start to wonder, too, with Democrats focused on impeachment, with Trump at the center of it, his ratings weakening a little bit, this issue within the Democratic primary of finding someone who's going to be the strongest candidate to take on Donald Trump still seems to be a key factor. To some extent, it looks like it's helping Biden stay at least near the top of the field.
Biden is, at least for now, towards the top of the field, but not everyone likes him that much in the Democratic Party. It's sort of like, well, this is the best we can get. He's older, he's more old school, he's not as exciting, he doesn't have that energy, he's had some missteps, he seems tired. I know that's the president's favorite way of attacking him, but there have been moments where Biden seemed a little out of it. And then this story with the Ukraine scandal, even though it's mostly focused on President Trump and what actions he took there, it also could drag Joe Biden down because the president will try and make Joe Biden the focus of the story, that his son did something not okay, not kosher. So it could end up smearing Joe Biden as well and not only hurting President Trump.
And Linda will maybe give you the last word on this, but I mean, Biden's been giving some interviews lately. His son gave an interview. So it seems like they sense that there may be some vulnerability here, even though, again, we have to emphasize there's been no evidence of any wrongdoing by the son or by Joe Biden as vice president there. There is a tactic here Republicans like to employ of just sort of getting something out there as questionable and running with it.
Exactly. The problem with the issue of the Bidens, so father Joe, son Hunter, is that even if what Hunter Biden did in Ukraine was legal, it doesn't look good for the sitting vice president's son to be on the board of an energy company of a country that Joe Biden, when he was vice president, was pressuring on issues of corruption. So the Democrats liked going after Donald Trump on the Ukraine issue because they said it was easy to explain. But frankly, it's becoming more and more difficult to explain, especially when you're defending Joe Biden. So you're right. They want to, the Democrats, the Joe Biden campaign, wants him to just put it all out there and hopefully put this issue to rest so that he can move on. But he's having trouble raising money. And he's now allowing outside money in the form of, this is legal, but big money from so-called super PACs to help him in this race. And that gives the sort of populist, progressive left wing of the Democratic Party another argument about the old Joe Biden who's trying to have his last hurrah in politics.
Well, it could be a long, drawn-out race. We're still months from the first vote, so we'll be keeping tabs on that as well. And with that, we're going to have to close this week's program. That's all the time we have. I want to thank Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Shana Estulin, correspondent for I-24 News. Our program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Jim Malone in Washington. As always, thanks for listening.